Raymond Lance v. Commissioner of Internal Revenue, Ms. McLaughlin.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Teresa McLaughlin and I represent the Commissioner. The Commissioner's position is that the tax court majority erred in invalidating the two-year rule for seeking equitable innocent spouse relief. On the first part of the Chevron analysis, the Commissioner's position is that the dissenters were the ones who were correct, that the statute does not speak to the precise question presented. Although the statute does contain two express two-year deadlines for seeking relief under subsections B and C.
Could you speak a little louder, Ms. McLaughlin?
Oh, certainly, Your Honor. The statute does contain two express deadlines, two-year rules, for seeking relief under subsections B and C of the statute, but it is merely silent on the timing of a request for equitable relief under subsection F. And this silence is what the tax court called audible silence, but we think that it really can't be construed as a congressional declaration that there can't be a like two-year deadline or that there can't be any deadline at all. In this situation, we think that the silence merely creates an ambiguity. And also, the text doesn't merely set two-year deadlines for the other two types of relief and say no more. Subsection F, which is the source of equitable relief, gives the Secretary extremely broad authority to prescribe procedures for dispensing equitable relief. The only limitations are that you can't have been eligible for relief under B or C, and it has to be inequitable under the facts and circumstances to hold the taxpayer liable.
Well, now, you concede that but for the time bar, it would have been inequitable to hold her liable for the tax liability. If we hold this regulation as valid, from a practical standpoint, what happens to Lance? Does she have any other recourse, or she's on the hook for this one point so many, the amount grows daily, this amount of tax?
Well, if this court were to uphold the regulation, she would be liable. She waived her right to seek deficiency review without paying in the tax court. She also waived her collection due process right to a hearing before the IRS Office of Appeals. But the IRS does have something called the Collection Appeal Program, where they give someone who has waived collection due process rights an equivalent hearing. And admittedly, it's not subject to judicial review, but what could possibly emanate is what her husband got, which, even though he exercised his rights, she could perhaps get currently not collectible. But in the event that, for instance, if she were to win the lottery, then the IRS could come in and collect.
Is there an explanation for why the Treasury Department picked 2 years for the subsection F?
Well, I don't know if there's a discussion of it in the preamble to the either to the proposed regulation or the final regulation, but we think that there are several reasons why the two-year rule makes sense and is at least plausible. First of all, we think that the Secretary really needn't take an ad hoc approach to timeliness in every case, even where a case-by-case approach is called for. Agencies can prescribe rules of general application. But we think that the two-year rule makes the most sense because, you know, even though the taxpayer's main complaint is that circumstances could arise after 2 years which would make it inequitable to collect the tax. But the same is true where relief is available under subsections B and C if you don't qualify.
I was just curious about the choice of 2 years. So presumably, so this is a Treasury regulation?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're 2 years. So presumably, you know, there are comments and this and that and the other. And I just wonder if there was some discussion of why 2 years rather than maybe 3 years or 6 months or what.
I don't think that there was, Your Honor, but one reason why 2 years may have been selected is that one of the conditions of relief under F is that you not be qualified for relief under B or C, and you have to seek relief under B or C within 2 years of the first collection action.
Now, so, F, am I right that B and C are just for understatements rather than for underpayments?
They are just for, you're correct, Your Honor.
F includes underpayments. So F can be a person who, you know, just doesn't have the money or something.
Yes. Well, this would be a person, you can get F relief for an understatement.
Also,
you know,
right.
Too.
Yeah.
But a person where there's an underpayment, where the return shows a tax due and owing and the taxpayer subscribed it, they're in a slightly less equity. I mean, many of these people, in an understatement case, you sign the return not knowing that it's understating your true tax liability, whereas in an underpayment case, you sign it perhaps thinking that your spouse is going to cover it and make the payment. So someone in an underpayment situation has a slightly less compelling claim to equity.
Right.
One thing, and the dissenters talked about this, in support of the two-year rule, which is that a like two-year rule for F claims would prevent the statute of limitations under subsection B and C from being undercut because if you, for instance, the taxpayer here is contending that she really would have qualified for relief under subsection B,
right.
Because the return contained an understatement she didn't know or have reason to know, and it's inequitable to hold her liable. And if she's granted relief under F, you know, if she'd come in timely and she were right about that, then she would be granted relief. And having a statute of limitations of longer than 2 years or no statute of limitations would, in fact, grant her relief when she would have been untimely under B.
So you're saying, let me make sure I understand, because I hadn't appreciated it. So you're saying, so suppose she has a perfectly good B or C claim, but it's 2 years and 1 month. So then she goes under F, and you're saying that's wiped out the two-year B or C limit.
Yes. And I think that is one of the effects of the tax court's decision in this case, because everything, all of the circumstances that make relief, you know, equitable if it's a timely request, in this case really happened before the two-year period was up. And by focusing on the same, like, you know, the closest legislative judgment we've got for a deadline is the deadline set for B or C. And if you center it on starting to run when the first collection action is taken, when you get your CDP notice, collection due process notice, or an offset, something like that, it brings everything to a head around the time when the most compelling circumstance is presented, which is, can you afford to pay this or not?
So let me ask you this hypothetical. What if a husband and wife were involved in an accident? The husband dies. The wife is in the coma. The husband's people are in control of the estate. The IRS assesses a deficiency, sends out the collection notice, gets the return receipt. Wife comes out of the coma 3 years later. Does she have any recourse?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, but I don't really like to fight your hypothetical, but shouldn't she have had her own guardian? And it may be if she's got someone who's looking out for her while she's in a coma, some fiduciary, and that fiduciary doesn't protect her, then perhaps she has a right of action for failing to bring an innocent spouse relief claim in a timely fashion.
So she'd have to go after whoever was in charge of her during the time she was in the coma. But it wouldn't necessarily waive her liability, her tax liability.
No, and the Supreme Court, in a case called Brockamp, refused to apply equitable tolling for a refund claim, and for a federal tax refund claim. And so that's the one instance where the Supreme Court looked at equitable tolling, and it rejected it. And certainly, this is a relatively new statute that only came on the books in 1998. We don't have any situations like that. But the commissioner would probably take the position that equitable tolling doesn't
apply.
What
is the name of that case?
Brockamp.
How do you spell that?
Brockamp.
What were the last?
Brockamp, Your Honor.
Brockamp. Okay, thanks.
So,
and let me ask you this. It seems pretty clear that he didn't provide, did he ask for the forms on her behalf, but there's no evidence he submitted it to the IRS, right?
Exactly, Your Honor. And his letter asking for the form is in the record. And there are case history notes for his collection due process proceeding, and Mrs. Lance did provide some records, or she was supposed to provide some records, but it's ambiguous whether they related to whether he could get anything done about the fact that he had paid some restitution.
Is the $2.6 million reimbursed to Medicaid the basis for the tax liability?
Well, we don't know too much of the details. There is a, I found on the internet a press release from the U.S. Attorney's Office that goes into details that this record doesn't contain.
But the couple didn't get a deduction for that amount in 2003, did they? The restitution amount.
The record doesn't show it, and although an embezzler is entitled to a loss in a transaction entered into for profit, there is actually a split of authority on whether you do get a deduction or whether it would conflict with the public policy doctrine if it's a condition of your sentence. So the record doesn't show, and I don't know whether he got a deduction for that. I did want to add before sitting down and for rebuttal that we think the two-year rule is practical in terms of ease of administration. People might not necessarily know what type of innocent spouse relief they qualify for, so it makes sense to prevent confusion to have them all applied for.
Is the commissioner's fear that we'll go from 2 years to 10 years? Is that based at the heart of this case? If you are not successful, that there's the exposure of five times the time?
Well, that's part of it, but I think there's also a concern that this is a Treasury regulation, written under a very broad grant of discretion that's been struck down, Your Honor.
Well, but let's just say that if it were not struck down and there is, in theory, a 10-year period because of the commissioner's time, and someone seeks the equitable relief, but as time goes on, they either accumulate more information or cannot. Other than being flooded by perhaps more inquiries because of an expanded time frame, how would it be an imposition on the commissioner if he or she were to have a longer period of time? In other words, I can see there might be more claims, but if you can't get the information, the discretion of the commissioner is so broad, he or she could just obviously reject the claim. So I'm trying to get the underlying fear here of the commissioner.
Well, I think that the commissioner would like to consider all the claims at the same time, and as some people will always have trouble meeting a deadline, but as time goes by and people let the situation get worse and worse, they
have
less
than equitable. That doesn't aid the claimant, though, right? I mean, that only enhances the power of the commissioner to exercise his or her discretion wisely, that there is no claim. I mean, here we've got an interesting case of a kind of seeming disparity in perhaps educational level and involvement in the operation of the accumulation of resources by the couple, which speaks to the decision to go after him, but that's not before us.
Well,
so I'm just from a policy standpoint trying to get a handle on the grave concern that causes you to want to appeal this ruling.
Well, it's a broad grant of discretion, and you know, even if the regulation is upheld, you know, maybe the taxpayer could go into bankruptcy, but you know, that would, I'm sure there might be a downside in that for her. I think it's the main thing is ease of administration, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Mr. McLaughlin. Mr. Kolhoff?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Kolhoff. I, along with co-counsel Robert Nadler, represent the taxpayer Kathy Marie Lance in this appeal. Without knowledge of the unreported income from her husband's Medicaid fraud, the taxpayer signed a joint tax return for 1999. An audit by the IRS assessed additional tax, and the taxpayer became jointly liable for over $1 million in tax and penalty. The taxpayer filed a request for equitable relief from this joint tax liability, and the IRS denied.
So is it your position that without a congressional amendment, the Treasury can't set any deadline on these claims?
Our position, Your Honor, is that Congress spoke
Answer my question, would you please?
We don't believe.
Just answer it, yes or no?
The answer would be no.
Right, thank you.
We believe under the Chevron analysis, Congress spoke to the precise question at issue.
Well, Congress didn't speak to the precise question. It didn't.
Could I try to explain
the
reasoning?
Sure.
The government wants you to focus on subsection F and only subsection F.
No, they don't. They want us to consider F in relation to B and C. In fact, I thought she made a very interesting point, which is that your position really wipes out B and C, because even if the person develops her B or C ground after 2 years so that she's barred from relief under B or C, she can come into F.
Your Honor, B, C, and F.
Is that correct?
That's not correct. B, C, and F are completely separate and distinct forms of innocent spouse relief. If the taxpayer has a claim under B or C and sits on her rights, she loses out.
No. Why can't she go under F?
Because of the IRS regulation that says it wasn't brought within the 2 years.
No, I don't understand you. What F says is the condition for F is taking into account all facts and circumstances inequitable if relief is not available under subsection B or C. So consider a situation in which the only reason relief is not available under B or C is that it's more than 2 years. But there are other equitable circumstances and so on. And then, under your view, this person could appeal to F. Isn't that correct?
The difference between B and F is that B is mandatory.
I don't think you're tracking me. This says if relief is not available to individual under B or C, you go into F.
Suppose
that the only reason relief isn't available under B or C is that it's more than 2 years. And then it seems to me, on your view, you're in F. Mm-hmm.
Right, but for the regulation. The regulation bars relief under F for the same reason that it wasn't available under B. It was untimely.
No, under your view, there's no deadline in F. That's your view, no deadline in F. If that's correct, if your view is correct, then someone who is ineligible under B or C because it's more than 2 years can get B or C type relief under F. Isn't that the implication of your position?
The factors under F are different than the factors under B.
Yeah.
You can overcome, for example, you can overcome knowledge or a reason to know about the deficiency in F. You can't do that in B. B is mandatory. In other words, if you can't show the four elements that are part
precisely.
Of B.
Precisely. Look, B or C are tight and difficult. Okay. But this says that this is a catch-all, that even if relief isn't available under B or C, you can get into F. And you may be able to get B or C type relief that couldn't quite fit in. And what's odd about your position, I think, is that even if this person is totally within B or C, but has missed it, has missed the two-year deadline, she can go under F and get B or C relief.
Mm-hmm. That's essentially the situation we have here in this case as it applies to the taxpayer.
That looks like a big loophole. That is, you strike out under B or C, then you come in under F.
It's a different form of relief, Your Honor. And this is what Congress intended.
No, there's not what Congress intended. There's no evidence of what Congress intended. Right.
Put a deadline.
Be realistic. Oh, be realistic.
Can I explain? They put a deadline in B.
Now look, they put a deadline in B or C, and then for F they said, this is the catch-all. We're going to leave it to the Treasury Department, right? It doesn't even say, look at the last line, the Secretary may relieve such liability of such individual, such liability. It doesn't even require relief. It just permits it.
That's
right?
Correct. It's discretionary.
But there's such a grant of discretion under procedures prescribed by the Secretary may relieve. Why couldn't the Secretary just say, well, we're never going to relieve such an individual of such liability if it's after 2 years? That's our exercise of discretion.
Congress could have put a two-year limitation.
Congress left it to the Treasury Department here. Under procedures prescribed by the Secretary, it didn't say the Secretary shall relieve such individual of such liability, may relieve it. So isn't it leaving everything up to the Treasury Department?
No, it's not, Your Honor. Under procedures described, it's the same language that Congress used in subsection B. Both subsection B and subsection F start with the very same words. But Congress put a limitation period in B, and they left it out of F.
B and C are both much more detailed than F, right?
Congress uses very specific wording in
that's
B and
true,
C.
But B and, that's a good point. That's fine. But B and C are very much more detailed, right? Everything's set out in B and C, including the deadline. And F seems to leave a lot more to the Secretary, doesn't it?
I think what Congress intended is to allow taxpayers who didn't qualify for B and C, and that would be in the case of a deficiency where they didn't file their request within 2 years of the first collection activity or an underpayment case. Congress intended them to be allowed to raise their claim under equitable relief. That's what we're talking about.
And you think they could raise that claim for the whole 10-year period?
The statute of limitations on collection is open for the 10-year period. At any time, they should be able to raise that equitable claim if the factors support their case. Now, I think in the first presentation there was a question about can they do this more than once? And the answer is no. They can only raise the claim for innocent spouse relief one time. So it's not going to be a situation where every 2 or 3 years during that 10-year statute of limitations the taxpayer will be able to come back and ask for equitable innocent spouse relief. But I think what the government is trying to get the court to focus on is the step two analysis of Chevron. I haven't heard much about Chevron, but I understand that is the precedent that controls the validity of the.
I don't see that. I don't see the relevance of Chevron. What you have is an ambiguous statute. But what strikes me is B and C are mandatory. B and C are detailed and mandatory. They grant rights to taxpayers and impose limits and this and that. And F is just very loose. And, I mean, I think your point about under procedures prescribed appearing all three sections, I think that's a good point. But F is still very short and very loose. And when it says the Secretary may relieve such individual of such liability, it seems to me it's saying, well, this is up to the Secretary, and presumably the Secretary can, adopt rules channeling this very broad discretion that she's been given.
Your Honor, we take the position that there is no gap here express delegation to the Secretary to set this deadline.
What is the significance of the Secretary may relieve such individual of such liability?
that under the factors that the IRS has promulgated for equitable relief, that, that those factors
what
might
factors?
Not be sufficient.
Where are their factors? I don't see that.
The factors are provided in a revenue procedure, 2003-61. And those factors include, for example, the marital status of the parties, the economic hardship that the collection of the tax liability would have on the taxpayer.
And I've lost you. These are regulations under F?
They're set forth in a revenue procedure, Your Honor.
Under
not,
F?
Not a regulation.
This is an F. This is an interpretation of F?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is it again?
And it's revenue procedure 2003-61. And so the,
and if the revenue procedure said 2 years, that wouldn't do it.
Well, the revenue procedure, I
mean, you're
I
saying the Secretary can define, can channel discretion with revenue procedures. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. These factors are to be considered by
and
the
why
Commission.
Why couldn't a factor be how long, whether it was more than 2 years? Why couldn't that be a factor?
I suppose it could have, but the IRS didn't write it that way. They wrote a 2-year bright line test that cuts off the right.
I don't understand. What's the difference between having that in a revenue procedure and in a regulation?
My understanding, Your Honor, a regulation is viewed under Chevron, under a revenue procedure. The court will use a Skidmore analysis.
Are you saying we would give. I don't understand you. Explain it again.
The revenue ruling includes a 2-year limitation. The revenue procedure not only includes the same 2-year limitation in F, but also the equitable factors that the IRS will consider for equitable relief. So the 2-year limitation is really in two places. It's in the Treasury regulation that we're looking at here. It's also in the revenue procedure.
But somehow you don't mind it in the revenue procedure. I don't get it.
Well, the government argued to the tax court that under the revenue procedure you'd use a Skidmore analysis, but that was rejected by the tax court, and the government didn't argue it in the brief. The government didn't argue the applicability of the 2-year period in the regulation. They're arguing, or in the revenue procedure, they've argued it in the regulation.
Well, we give more weight to regulations than revenue procedures.
Right.
But somehow you seem not to be concerned with the 2 years in the revenue procedures. Puzzled by
Your
that.
Honor, our position is Congress spoke on this.
Well, no, Congress did not speak. That's so artificial. I mean, obviously.
At the plain language of the statute.
Plain language, no. It's a missing language, not plain language.
Plain language
would be saying, F, equitable relief available at any time or within 10 years. That would be plain language, all right. You don't have that.
Your Honor, the legislature is entitled to use whichever language it wants in its statute. Mm. And in this particular case, we think the language is clear. Mm. Statutes
the language, of limitation. The language is missing. I don't see how it can be clear. It's a vacuum. There's no reference to 2 years.
There's in the entire statute. There's two references to a 2-year period. You have to look at the statute as a whole. You can't just pull out subsection F and look at that. That's not how the rules of construction work. You have to look at the language that was used in the entire statute. And in two particular.
You're actually unwilling to connect B and C with F.
We think they're.
Because you think that someone who doesn't satisfy B or C because she's waited more than 2 years can get relief under F, which obviously undermines B and C.
No, it's a separate form of relief, Your Honor. And it's discretionary. In other words, it's still up to the discretion of the IRS to grant the relief under
B. So why can't it say, we believe that our discretion should be limited to 2 years?
Because that cuts off the rights of taxpayers.
But any channeling of discretion will cut off the rights of taxpayers.
A statute of limitations is a legislative judgment for the legislature to make, and they made their judgment.
That's a completely different argument.
It's a balancing of interests.
You're not saying that administrative agencies can never set deadlines.
I'm not saying that.
Ms. Kohlhoff, so I can be clear. You read up as a 10-year relief period, right?
Mm-hmm. At any time during the statute of limitations for collection, yes.
So it's 10 years?
Yes, 10 years.
And if the secretary said 30 months or 36 months, so in addition to the BC period, you would find that that the secretary could not do that?
We would think that that violates congressional intent. I mean, Congress knew about the 10-year statute of limitations for collection. They actually referenced it in 6015 at subsection E2. So it wasn't that it wasn't on their mind. And the deadline...
You know what's on congressmen's minds?
Yeah, you can presume that if they included
and
it in...
You understand how the congressional process works? And
I do, Your Honor.
And congressmen actually know what's in the Internal Revenue Code?
Your Honor, the Congress heard testimony from several witnesses who experienced this type of an issue with the IRS. And I think we can presume from that they were trying to solve the problem.
You want to be realistic about the legislative process, don't you?
It's not up to the courts to rewrite the statute.
And in that testimony of those witnesses, they specifically discussed the statute of limitations. I thought the testimony focused on the problem and the need to have a catch-all if you didn't fall into B or C. There was no specific discussion of the year, was it?
Prior to the enactment of 6015, there was an innocent spouse statute that provided for one form of relief. It was 6013E,
right.
I believe. And it had no limitation period.
Right. So what I'm asking, though, is you were making reference to the testimony that occurred. And so, specifically, was there anything said about the statute of limitations?
No, but I don't think that was
so
discussed by the witnesses, no.
Right. So,
but there are ordeals.
Oh, I understand that. The
went
need
on for years.
For the need, the need for it, I understand. That was discussed. But I'm saying we're trying to read Congress's mind. There was no specific testimony about the statute of limitations.
Not from the witnesses.
And then this other, you said there was some reference to the 10 years?
In 6015
right,
itself.
And what specifically was the reference?
That during the time period where a claim for innocent spouse is being considered by the IRS, including a petition to tax court, the 10-year statute of limitations is suspended during that time period. So Congress
during
knew.
During the time that it was being considered.
Yes. So Congress was fully aware that there's a 10-year statute of collections. And they could have easily put in any kind of limitation period they wanted in F. But they were aware that these things drag on for long periods of time, and they wanted to allow the taxpayer to have the right to raise the equitable relief claim at any time during that 10-year period.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kohlhoff. So, Ms. McLaughlin, does she have any time? No, but you can have a minute if you want.
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to point out, in response to the contention that subsection B also starts with under procedures prescribed by the secretary. That language is not found in subsection C. Subsection C is captioned procedures and then goes on. And in subsection C, there are some embedded express regulatory delegations. A clue to what Congress might have been thinking, even as to subsection B, much of which was familiar, is if you look at subsection F, which is a grant of rule writing authority, it talks about part of what they had in mind was procedures for allocating items between spouses who have separate liability, and also a new procedure that applied even to B and C for giving the other spouse notice and opportunity to participate. So that might be what Congress...
Can you just answer this? So what do you make of that reference to the 10 years and the fact that things would be suspended, during that period while these were being considered?
Well, I think that when you bring a case under Section 6015, I think that that's an exception, statutory exception to the Anti-Injunction Act. So... I think that the commissioner can't collect while a standalone 6015E proceeding is going. And throughout the code, Whenever Congress says that the commissioner can't collect, it has a practice of suspending the statute of limitations on collection for that same time, and I think that that's all that that does.